You're listening to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, bringing class to trash since 1977.
Welcome back to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. I am Large William. Across the border from me today is not Sammy. Sammy is getting the GPS in his 1982 Pontiac Trans Am fixed. His adventures were dwindling without GPS capabilities. So we put the bat signal in the sky and had a dear friend come back after many a moon. Good friend Rufus is back in the mix. Rufus, how are you?
Hey, I'm glad to be back. I actually went back and listened to our old episode, which was like 13, 14 years ago. Gosh. And I had to laugh because one of the big discussions pre-show was, do you think these new streaming services and their content is going to take off?
Yeah. That's nuts. That's not. It's funny how much things have changed just in that time.
For real.
It's changed. Like, it just, it's wild, man. It's wild. It's now, yeah, here we are, right? But, and it's funny how quickly that time seemed to go, right? Because, you know, we would stay in contact.
Sure, of course. Yeah.
And when opportunity arose, get together. But it's hard to believe that it's been 13 years.
I know. It's nuts. And hopefully it's not 13 years until I'm on again.
No, because Sammy wants, like, he wanted to be on with you. But like I said, Trans Am things.
Of course. Yeah.
You know. So how have you been, man? Let people know sort of who you are, where your tastes lie, and give them a little sample platter of Mr. Rufus.
Sure. So I was pretty much known as the Korean film guy for a long time. Yeah. Wrote a lot about Korean film pretty early on in English. Programmed for New York Asian Film Festival. Did some work with Film Society at Lincoln Center. And then more recently, I moved up to my hometown in Connecticut to be closer to family. And it's a little rural. It's about 45 minutes to anything. but I'm finding things to do. I'm part of this group up here called Boondocks Film Society. So we do pop-up film events once a month in unique locations, and we pair movies with local chefs, local craft beer and craft cocktails paired with the movie. And then we usually have a band or some sort of performance ahead of the film. So like this week, next weekend, we're doing Strictly Ballroom. Mm-hmm. And we have a flamenco dancer, some meat pies coming, and some good cocktails and some beer, local craft beer.
So what you're saying is you're living the dream.
I am. We don't make any money on it, but it's a fun time. And we've done a lot of stuff. So we did Hot Rod. We had Yorma Taccone there with us, and then he got Andy Samberg and all of the Lonely Island guys to record videos introduction, and we did that at the local drive-in, and we had a live hawk as one of the friends of the animal kingdom. We had flaming Dr. Pepper s'mores. It was just like, it was a wild time. We had an 80s hair metal cover band. It was pretty fun.
That sounds like a good time. It sounds like you're living, as the kids say, living your best life.
I am. I love being up here. I love being closer to family. We love our house. So I'm pretty happy, I have to admit.
You know, it's one of those things where, as you get older, you know, you miss the city and all that, but it's nice to be able to have kind of stillness. Sure. In your life, just to reflect and just slow it down a little bit, man.
Yeah, I mean, we can go hiking and, you know, like, and we're 10 minutes away from the train station. So if we really want to go into the city, not going to be, it's hour and a half, maybe 2 hours, and we're in Grand Central.
Yeah. Best of both, man. Best of both. That's good. Give people, you know, what do you, give me five Desert Island films.
Ooh.
We won't hold you to these tomorrow.
I would say Blade Runner and Lost Boys. 7 Samurai. Memories of Murder. And Hanyo, the Housemaid from 1960.
Nice.
Korean film.
Very nice. And that got a, I think that got a Criterion release. Did it, was it on the remake, or was it paired with the remake, or did it?
Well, Scorsese put it out as part of the Treasures of World Cinema on disc, and then it was streaming on the Criterion channel for a while.
Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah. It's a, I mean, it's one of my all time favorite movies. It's fantastic, weird, psychosexual thriller. Yeah. Starring a very, very, very young An Sung-gi. He's the little kid in the movie.
That's crazy. That's crazy, man. Well, that's good. That's a very good list, to be sure. Okay, cool, man. What, we're just getting through spooky season here. Did you watch this horror, or did you mix it up?
We mixed it up. Well, of course, in my house, it's the first week of November, so that means Hallmark, because my mom lives with us. So we watched Mystic Christmas and Flipping for Christmas. The rule is that we're allowed to gently provide commentary as we watch.
That's fair, I think.
Yeah. But you know what? Like, I was thinking about this, you know, like, you guys always say different strokes for different folks. Like, I'm not mad. Like, Hallmark knows what they're doing. They have an audience for this. It means a lot to them. They like these sort of romantic
or sentimental.
They're sentimental. They're about simple ideas. They're about family and relationships. And, you know, I can see the appeal. I will say that Mystic Christmas, because it was filmed in Mystic, Connecticut, was hilarious, because they turned the fake village that's down there. It's like a seaboard town. It has a big aquarium. It's a tourist place in Connecticut. And there's a fake village that's just sort of retail shops, like, you know, tourist tchotchkes and stuff. And so in the movie, they pretend that people actually live there. So they made a fake village even faker. that was pretty funny. Some of the highlights, I think, we watched Arsenic and Old Lace, which is one of my all time favorite movies. Cary Grant is just so good in that movie. I rewatched John Carpenter's Vampires.
Yes.
Which is just so fun and stupid.
Yeah. Yes, and it is.
I love the sort of weird world building that it's trying to do. We watched The Fall of the House of Usher on Netflix. the Mike Flanagan series, which we really like. I love the Mike Flanagan stuff that he's been doing with Netflix. Just super interesting way he tells stories and uses the camera. And I like how he focuses a lot on like storytelling within the story, characters telling stories.
Yeah.
Watched Jurassic World Dominion, which was awful.
That's just true.
I love dinosaur movies. I love Jurassic Park. How do you make a movie about dinosaurs that have like broken out and are in the real world causing havoc, and then don't make a movie about dinosaurs and you make a movie about giant bugs?
That's wild.
It blew my mind how poorly conceived that movie was.
You know, that's one of those things, and you have certainly much more of a inside baseball on this, but just as a guy who loves film and watches a lot of film, there's times I'll watch stuff and I go, man, who greenlit this? Who thought this was a good idea? Because it's not just one person.
No, it's a team, and it's all based on IP and like how you can control the copyright. I mean, it's so
God
gross, really.
It's gross, man.
I watched Terrified, the 2017 Damien Rugna movie. That was amazing.
And did you see his new one, When Evil Lurks?
No, so that's on my queue to watch.
Yeah, I was gonna try to check that out Halloween night, but I didn't because we try to watch one that's set on Halloween
sure,
right? Yeah. And that one, to be honest, man, like he's a real bruiser of a filmmaker. And I've heard this one is like Haneke does horror. Yeah. So I got to be ready for this. I can't be like having a bad day and watch it because it's going to bruise me up pretty good. So,
yeah, that's why it was actually playing when we were up in Toronto.
Oh, yeah.
But Emily hates horror movies, and she especially hates like gory slashery kind of stuff. Yep. And I was like, then we cannot watch this because I know it's going to be kind of gross.
It's going to be gross and very downbeat. And yeah.
What else did I do? Oh, I watched Bottoms. I loved it. I thought it was it's one of my favorite movies of the year. I think it's so funny and awkward and weird. And it just leans into being super weird.
Yep.
Which I thought was kind of brave in this day and age of Hollywood filmmaking. Movies are too afraid to get weird.
Yeah, they are, because, again, they are trying to appeal to a swath and as wide a swath as they can. So to be a little more specific, they don't want to do it, right? So
yeah,
I like Rachel Bennett, man. She's good.
Yeah, she's hilarious. I mean, everything in the movie was just like, I love that, like the football team had their own tablecloth seats in the cafeteria. It's just like, it's so brilliant.
Yeah, I think she's one that we're going to see in a couple years. Is going to be like a straight up A-lister.
Oh, 100%.
She's making some really good moves. She's in some buzzy stuff. It just seems like more buzzy stuff every year. Shiva Baby was the first time I saw her. She's really great in that.
Yeah. And I really liked Ayo Edebiri too. I thought she was hilarious and fun.
Nice.
Yeah. What else did I watch? Oh, speaking of weird, Tammy and the T-Rex. I showed my friends the R-rated version, and they were like, what the hell is this movie? We watched that in a double feature with Ghost Nursing, which is a Hong Kong black magic movie. Not a great one, but it was pretty fun. Watched Totally Killer on your recommendation and had a blast.
Super fun, man. Super fun.
Like, we had a really, just really good time. And actually, Emily watched that too. And I was like, Emily, this is a slasher movie.
Did she dig it though?
And she turned away from the kills, but she had a pretty good time. I think it was the addition of the comedy. And I was like, yeah, but most slashers, especially from the 80s, have comedy in it. Or they're unintentionally comedic. They're
unintentionally meat-headed comedic or something. But
yeah.
No, this one, yeah, it's well-written. Like, I'm not saying I think for what it is, it's well-written.
Sure.
It's snappy. It's got energy. The cast is uniformly pretty good. It's kind of this high concept. The kills are still good. Like, it's not like it's all at the sacrifice of the kills, because the kills are pretty brutal still in the film.
Yeah, they're really brutal.
Sound design, people getting stabbed. It's like, ooh.
What else did I watch? Oh, I think I had two surprises. So All American Murder. Have you ever seen that?
Dude, I love
Anson Williams. That was almost going to be my pick for today, because I was blown away by how much I love that movie.
I love it. This is the one. Is this the one where I think it's Christopher Walken's a detective in it?
Oh my God, he's the best detective. It's just like nonstop one-liners.
He's got that. Oh, he's got one of the. He's got a, like, when he's walking up to a crime scene. I can't remember what it is, but he has this little, this scene with him, and he's walking up, and it's just, I died, man. He's so good in it. I love that film. It's pretty fun. That might be, maybe save that. When Rick,
we should all three of us should do that. I love just like, there's the scene where he's with like, the main character is like sleeping with the dean's wife, and she's like, one of my duties is the dean's wife. I fuck you, you fuck me, we fuck the dean. I'm like, this movie is just like bonkers.
Yeah, it's nuts.
And then the other one that I'm going to cheat a little, because I watched this a while ago, but it's on Hulu now, and I'm trying to like sort of sing its praises, is To Catch a Killer.
Yep.
Damien Zifron, or I don't know how to pronounce his last name. Sorry, Damien. Shailene Woodley, Ben Mendelsohn. It's like a...
Oh, yes, yes. I heard this was really good from people that...
It's really good. It's like a... It's like one of those 90s crime films that... Yep. Like, don't really get made anymore. It's just really grounded, really interesting... goes off the rails a little bit in the last third, but overall, like, I really, really liked it. It's very dark. It's dour, but Shailene Woodley and Ben Mendelsohn are just like so good.
For her to keep up with him is testament to her skill, because I think he's one of the most, like, I feel like he's like the Gary Oldman no one talks about.
I literally just made that reference to somebody.
Did you really?
The other day. Yes.
He so is. He gets into the role and you don't see him anymore.
Dude, look, what's the one with Place Beyond the Pines?
I know. Yeah.
He has such a small role in that, and he's one of the most memorable things about that movie.
Yep.
100%. He's so good. And Shailene Woodley is like right up there with him in this movie.
That's good, man.
Sort of playing this like sort of down on her luck cop who has some psychological issues. It's just so good.
I got to see. I feel like the missus watched this one. And if she didn't, then I'm going to, because it sounds like it's right up her alley. So I'm guessing she's already watched it. But if not, then I might say, hey, let's watch this one.
Yeah, that's my big recommendation for the what I watched for the listeners. Like, it's on Hulu, at least in America. Do yourself a favor and watch it.
Nice. Very nice. Okay. I kept it spooky all season. What did I watch towards the back end of the year? So I watched a few things. Have you ever seen Lucio? I almost said Leon Fulci. Lucio Fulci's Enigma?
No.
It's called the Enigma, Aenigma. So this one's nuts. It's late cycle Fulci does Patrick meets Carrie.
What?
Yeah. It's fun. It's really fun. It's really sleazy. And again, I think this is testament to, because Rick and I have been very open about this. When the show first started, we kind of pushed back on all like the Fulci lives and all the Fulci.
Yeah.
It was like, come on, man, he's not that good. But really, like, here we are 15 years later and, you know, he's money in the bank. And this one, it feels very, other one this totally riffs on. And I feel like he's so riffing on this, like, as sort of a, like, poking fun at it. It's like his version of Phenomena, like Argento's Phenomena.
Wow. I gotta watch it, because I just watched Contraband for the Bunch first time. Good. Because I won it. I won the DVD at the X Fest.
Yeah, that's right, man. That's right.
Man, I'm adding this to my watch list. It looks good. Awesome.
I'm not saying like it's a world beater, but I threw it on a Sunday and I was like, this is good. This will do just fine right now.
Sometimes that's all you need.
That's all you need, man. That's all you need. One of the kids wanted to watch. It was Friday the 13th. So we watched the final chapter, which I think is part four. I never remember.
I can't remember all of them. Okay. We watched the first one with I watched the first one with my mom on Friday the 13th.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Sweet.
My mom's a big horror movie buff, so.
See? Does she have like a jam? Does she have like a go-to jam? Like, what do you
know? She loves like ghost movies. So like one of her favorites is probably like Burnt Offerings. Or there's this one, I think it's called The Haunted or The Haunting.
Yes. I know The Haunted. Good one.
Yeah. Yes. With Adrian Lynn. Wait, I can't remember. It's a good movie.
I think is that the pillow whispering, I think, in one scene.
I think so.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's he goes to this like house and like it's haunted and he's kind of like, no, that it's not. And, you know, nice. Typical. But yeah, she likes everything. Like she watched almost all of those horror movies that I just listed with us.
Oh, good for moms, man.
Yeah.
Shout out to the moms and the dads that do that, man. That's
for sure.
That's amazing. Went to see Halloween 3 on the big screen with our buddy Kurt, and it was a blast. Took our kids. Like, he took his boy, our two boys.
Has Kurt ever seen that before?
So he has.
Okay.
But he liked it, didn't love it when he'd first seen it. I think the first Halloween he saw was 4. So he's like, he's very much like, he loves Halloween. Like right. That franchise loves them. You know, I die on the hill that 3 is my favorite. And
dude, 3 is so good. I love 3.
3 is my favorite. My guys love 3.
I have some controversial Halloween opinions. Like, I really like the Rob Zombie movies.
So I think that the violence in those is really good. Yeah. I don't love his origin story for Michael. Like, it's a little too on the nose for me. But sure. But I want to go back and watch them now because I feel like enough time has passed that I can dig into them, but 3 was great with an audience, man. Everyone cheering every time.
I'm super jealous. I wish I could see that on the big screen.
Yeah, the crowd goes nuts when Dr. Dan Chalice is just like kissing ladies and solving mysteries, and it was fun. It was fun with the crowd. Shout out to the Review in Toronto. Great, just a great theater, man. Lots of cool stuff going on. Next up was one that our buddy Tanner recommended. Have you seen Dark Harvest?
Is that the Scarecrow one?
Yeah.
That just came out, right?
Yeah.
It was good. I was actually pretty surprised by that. Yeah, I actually don't think I logged that.
I liked it. I was pleasantly surprised. So it feels... So I think it was adapted from like a young adult book, if memory serves. It feels... Like it's kind of got this really good looking sort of Riverdale aesthetic, like in terms of it's very stylized. I think so I liked it quite a bit. There's a few missteps in it, like a few choices I would have. One of the performances was really bad. Like the sheriff I thought was terrible in the film.
Right.
But otherwise, I really liked the two leads in it. I love the setting, like it's set in like 1962 or something. This was a really pleasant surprise, man. Really pleasant surprise.
Yeah, David Slade is interesting. Like, I love Hard Candy and 30 Days of Night.
Yeah, he's got a... And it's funny because...
He did one of the Twilight movies, I think.
He did. He totally did because I think he had made a Twilight movie and then made another film and used some of the same people in it, or maybe it was vice versa. But he's an interesting filmmaker. He's definitely got some good films under his belt, and I didn't realize it when I put it on. And then I started digging. I'm like, oh, okay, this makes sense. Good film, man. Cool, kind of. It's very vibey, like Halloween, takes place on Halloween. And it's, you know, surprisingly got some heart, right? Like at the back end, there's some stuff that happens. I think Pumpkinhead must have been a bit of an influence just in terms of having an emotional kind of a heartbeat. Good one. Decided to rewatch Edge of the Axe, when we were decorating because I love Edge of the Axe. And I love that we live in a world that Edge of the Axe has a Blu-ray.
It's wild. That's another thing that's changed a lot in the 13 years since I've been on this show. Sheer amount of trash and class on Blu-ray.
And not even just Blu-ray, dude. 4K.
I know. I was a subscriber of the Vinegar Syndrome subscriber. I can't this year because of jobs, but like the past couple years, you know, some of the releases I watch and I'm like, oh, this movie's not for me. And then some of the releases I'm like, I cannot believe that this movie has a 4K release.
There's stuff that we never would have thought would have had. Like Rotor probably has a 4K release.
Oh my God.
That's the world when it's amazing. Rewatch Zombieland. So this is one I feel like in our community, some people probably thumb their noses at, like we're kind of too cool for it. But I got to say, man, Braden loves this film. And every time I watch it, I have a good time with it. Like, I think the kills are good. It's pacey. The cast is good. Like, you know, yeah, we were into zombies a million years ago, but some people are just discovering zombies for the first time. And listen, I think it's a fun film, man.
I remember, like, I haven't watched it since it probably came out, but I thought I remember liking it when it came out.
It's fun. Every time I watch it, like every time he goes to put it on, I'm not like, groan, but I'm like, oh, we've already seen it. But then we put it on and I always have a really good time with it. It's fun.
I mean, it's probably a better rewatch than Flesh Eater.
Yeah. Yeah, man. And that's pretty much it. Rewatched Halloween. What can I say about that? We've covered the film. Everyone, you know, under the sun.
Sure.
You know, Halloween's great. The only thing I will say is I didn't realize how many blues, like sort of cold hues there were in this film at the back end.
Interesting.
And then I watched, there's like an Instagram account I follow, Video Nasties, and they'll do like that.
Was that like a recoloring? Did he re-time it when it got released for the anniversary?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. But I do know, like, this account, all they do is they'll take, like that color spectrum and they'll put it below, like, either a still or a sequence in a film.
Right, right, yeah.
And so I was watching, I'm like, this is really blue. And then I saw that that reel and I was like, yeah, this is a very blue.
I asked because I just rewatched Heat.
Yep.
And I was sitting there, I'm like, I don't remember it being this blue. And then I looked up and he had re-timed the color when he did the sort of re-release with the extra material that he edited back in to make it more like his newer aesthetics.
Yeah, because I think isn't Miami Vice a very blue film as well?
Super blue. Yeah. Super blue.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know, man. That's all right, well that's what we've watched. Lots of good stuff in there. I don't have a watch on, but I do know that the clocks went back an hour. And speaking of clocks, Rufus, you know what time it is.
It's time for Dis or Dat.
Yeah.
Et qui fera ça t'apprendra n'importe quoi pour moi.
All right, so yeah, it is time for This or That. Rufus, I am going to defer to you as the guest first. Do you have any This or That's?
I've been thinking about this. I had a couple. So Ringo Lamb or Johnny Toe?
I got to go Johnny Toe, man. I love both. I absolutely love both.
I was thinking about this, and I have to go Johnny Toe, too, because I feel that the bulk of his films are more consistently good.
Agreed.
Where that, Ringo Lam has very high highs and then a lot of mids.
He totally does. And I also feel like, yeah, I just feel like there was a time when Johnny Toe was the guy that was he was the guy that had the whole, the Hong Kong film industry. He was just carrying it. And he just kept making good film. Like, you knew he wasn't going to shit the bed.
Yeah.
He was just making good film, good film. And then if you look at his earlier stuff, like you and I talked about this, stuff like Running on Karma. Like, he's made a lot of kind of weird off. Like, it's not just like gangster stuff.
Oh, dude. Like one of my favorite movies of his is Turn Left, Turn Right.
Yeah.
Where it's sort of like that romantic comedy, but like the characters just one turns left and one's turned right, and they just don't meet each other for like the bulk of the film.
Yeah, he is a filmmaker that I think it's easy to get kind of like Scorsese, where if you look at like After Hours or what's it called with Jerry Lewis and De Niro,
King of Comedy,
or like Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, you know, or like it's easy to forget. Because they're pulpy kind of cops and robbers and gangster stuff so good that they're really diverse filmmakers.
Yeah.
Very cool. How about I'm gonna keep it in Hong Kong.
Okay.
Billy Tang or Nam Nat Choy?
Oh. Oh man, that's a hard one. I think I have to go Nam Nat Choy.
Yeah, man. I'm with you on that. Like, Billy Tang's got some good stuff, but I don't think he reaches quite the highs. Because Choy run, man.
Yeah, I think Nam Nat. Yeah, Choy, for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
That's a close one, now.
No, it is. Billy Tang's got some good stuff.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And of course, Billy Tang threw his hat in the ring and directed one of the Raped by an Angel films.
Yes. Yep.
So, there you have it.
Yeah, but Billy, oh, man. No, I'm sticking with Choy. I was like, oh, man, but Billy Tang has some fun movies. But, yeah, Choy. I don't see. I don't know if you, like I can't remember how far back the this or that. So I don't know if you guys have done this, but Vinegar Syndrome or Severin?
We have not. We have not. So I think first, let me just say I think both labels are amazing.
Of course, that's why this is a hard one. I think
this is a very hard one. I love Severin, but I feel like at this point in the game, I got to give it to Vinegar Syndrome, because I feel like, and I was talking, because Vinegar Syndrome just opened up a brick and mortar store here in Toronto.
In Toronto, yeah.
Which is super cool.
There's one about 45 minutes from my house, because everything's 45 minutes from my house in their home base in Bridgeport.
So, but I just feel like right now, they're really firing on all cylinders. They've made a lot of really good decisions consistently. They're people that obviously love films. For a long time, you know, Rick and I would say Arrow is kind of the gold standard for genre stuff, but I feel like Vinegar Syndrome's in that conversation.
I think Arrow's fallen off a little bit.
Yeah. I think Arrow's, I'll tell you what.
Don't get me wrong. I just got their video box set with RoboJocks because I needed RoboJocks.
But their streaming service is great, though.
Yes, Arrow's streaming service is
amazing. A lot of Hong Kong stuff that doesn't really have a good release over here. So
yeah, their Shaw Brothers box sets are really good.
Yeah, they are. So I don't want to dethrone them yet. But Vinegar Syndrome is superb. I'm going to give it to Vinegar Syndrome, even though I love Severin as well.
Yeah, I'm also going to give it to Vinegar Syndrome, even though Severin has had some of my favorite releases in the last 2 years. But again, if you're talking about high highs, I think Vinegar Syndrome's really knocked it out of the park with some of their bigger boxes and like their, you know, 4K Roadhouse. What?
Come on, man. Yeah. Yeah.
4K Beastmaster. That's not something anybody needed, but I needed it.
Gregory, man, Sammy's guy, Mark Gregory. Yeah, that's what's up. Yeah. Okay, so this one I'm gonna drop one in from our good friend Metal George.
Okay.
Leon Klimovsky or Coffin Joe?
I'm gonna say Coffin Joe. Just because I'm more familiar with more of his works.
Okay, that's fair. So I'm gonna kind of say something on air, man, that I've never really said. I haven't really been into Coffin Joe, man. Like, I'm aware of Coffin Joe. I love what Coffin Joe did, but I am by no means a Coffin Joe expert.
Yeah, I'm not a Coffin Joe expert either. I know him. I mean, I know Trauma and some of the other movies, but Coffin Joe, I've seen more of his movies.
So that's fair, right? And I guess that's got to go. But I'm going to take that train of thought the other way.
I mean, a few dollars for Django, though. Ooh.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, man, maybe I need to rethink this.
Well, they're both good, man. They're both good. I got to go Klimovsky because I've seen a lot more Klimovsky, and he's made some good stuff, right? So, yeah, I think that's a good one, you know, two guys that were doing the work. And it's funny, you know, Klimovsky worked with Nashi a fair bit, and that's funny. I was thinking about Nashi watching World on a Wire, but anyway.
He would have been great in that movie.
Would have had his shirt off. Oh, I know why it was, because the lead always had his shirt off.
Of course.
Man, it's a Nashi move right there.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm gonna go Klimovsky on that one. Do you got any more?
I'm gonna say I'm interested in your thoughts on Park Chan-wook versus Bong Joon-ho.
Oh my God, that was the one I was about to give you. But I was gonna make it a this, that, or the other, and add in Lee Chang Dong.
Oh, that's a mean one.
Oh, dude, that was my next one. I'm like, okay, so he's gonna say one, and then I'm gonna finish with that. So okay, okay. So you asked me first. Ooh, yeah. I'm getting a hot seat right now. So here's the thing. 15, 18 years ago, I probably would have said, no, I definitely would have said Park Chan-wook.
Sure.
And because to me, like when I first got into the Korean New Wave, he was the man. For me, he spoke to me the most. At that point in my life, I was in my early 20s. His work just hit. And for me, he kind of fell off a little bit. He was still making good films. But he fell off, but I watched Decision to Leave this year and I was just blown away, man. I thought about it for like a week. I really, really, really loved it. I think he's great. And I think Lee Chang Dong is an incredible filmmaker. He's a little different than those two.
Sure. Of course.
His stuff I think is more spiritual, more serious. It's a little more serious minded and kind of outside of some of the genre trappings that those guys are into. But I think I got to go, and I didn't think I would ever say this. I got to go Bong Joon-ho, man. I just feel like at this point in the game, he's really firing on all cylinders, right? And maybe it's a timing thing, as with everything in life, right? So for me, I feel like where I'm at this point in my life, I got to go Bong Joon-ho. Oh, that's
a hard one.
Damn it. You know what? Nope, I'm not, man. I love Bong Joon-ho, man. Last minute, I'm changing my mind. I got to stick with my guy, Park Chan-wook. On the strength of Decision to Leave, because otherwise, if this was a boxing match, I would have feel like at the back few rounds, Bong Joon-ho is just killing him. But I'm going to go Park Chan-wook.
I see, this is the thing. Oh. It's like,
I feel too good about that, though, if I'm being real.
I think it's Bong Joon-ho for me.
Yeah.
I think Yi Cheng Dong, it has some of the greatest masterpieces. I mean, Peppermint Candy.
Oh, I love Peppermint Candy so much.
You know, Poetry, Secret Sunshine, Like, these are just, and like, his even his screenwriting, yeah. Single Spark, like some of these earlier movies he collaborated with other directors on, all time cinema classics, not just for Korean cinema classics.
Yeah. But
Bong Joon-ho, man, I gotta say, don't get me wrong, love Park Chan-wook. Like, I think Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance is one of the best revenge movies in Korean cinema. Yep. I like it more than Old Boy.
I think it's a bruiser. I think it's such a bruiser of a film.
It's so hard.
It is a hard film.
And I was living in Korea when Sympathy for Lady Vengeance came out and The Host came out.
Wow.
And that sort of clinched it for me for Bong Joon-ho. Memories of Murder is, I think, my favorite of that era of Korean cinema. And I think he's been just so consistent.
He has been.
And Parasite's amazing. Like, and even movies where I have some issues, like Snowpiercer, still, like, the way he frames action and the way he uses the cinematic language to underscore the themes and story he's telling, I think it's just, he has a long career ahead of him. So do A. Chang Dong and Park Chan Wook.
But yeah, like, yeah. Oh, for sure.
Bong Joon-ho is like, also, out of the three of them, I'd rather get a beer with Bong Joon-ho.
Maybe. So he seems just beyond lovely for sure. But it's funny because my kids, we did like a Snowpiercer Okja, like not a double, but like within a few weeks of each other. And like they were making trains with their Lego and
right.
Really loved Snowpiercer when they saw it. And Okja's great. Like, I think that's a hard one, man. And I don't
even Barking Dogs Never Bite. Yeah. His first movie. Just so good. Beidou Na is so good in that movie.
Yes. You know which one, man, I always mean to see, speaking of Korean films from that era, or not see, but to review on the show, is The Foul King.
Oh, dude, if you want to do that, I love that movie.
Yeah, so do I, man. And I don't know if Sammy's seen it, but I've always wanted to drop it on the show and maybe we'll do that.
Yeah, let's do that. We got a couple movies to do. Yeah,
definitely. Okay, so I'm just going to give you one more.
Okay.
Just to finish off here. I can't believe yours was mine. That's so funny. I mean,
Kim Ji-woon is another one that could have been on that list.
So, you know what's funny, man? I remember Kim Ji-woon for a while was like, it was running neck and neck for me personally. And I went to see I Saw the Devil during TIFF with Young Cool Cat. And I was pretty disappointed in it, man.
I didn't like it. I'll be honest. I think it's too mean.
It is too mean, and I'd said this, and I've said it on the show before. I feel like it's like a chocolate Easter bunny, where it's like sweet on the outside, like not sweet, but like nice to look at on the outside, but it's very hollow on the inside. And might have been just an exercise in style for its own sake, but I was very disappointed when I left that film.
Yeah, I was not a fan. You know, I love, you know, Quiet Family, Good, Bad, and Weird, Bittersweet Life, you know. And then I Saw the Devil, I was like, ugh. And then The Last Stand, I was like, ugh.
I didn't mind The Last Stand, but listen, I'm using.
I gave both, like, to be fair, I gave like 3 out of 5 stars for Last Stand and I Saw the Devil.
Yeah, they're not. I don't know. I don't really have an inclination to want to go and watch I Saw the Devil again. But I do. I want to go revisit Bong Joon-ho's Mother, because I really liked it, but didn't love it when I saw it at TIFF, and I feel like I'm due for a rewatch of that.
Yeah, I need to rewatch that too. That's kind of my least favorite of his films.
Yeah, same. That's why I say that. So I'm curious to go back and look at some of the stuff now and see how it sits with me. Like the other two films in the Vengeance trilogy, Mother. Right, just to go back and see how they sit, but I don't know.
Yeah, if you rewatch the Sympathy for Lady Vengeance, because in my head I'm always like The Kindly Miss Kumja, which is the Korean title.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. If you rewatch that, watch the fade to black and white version.
Yes.
I think it's better.
Yeah, that's true. That was the thing with that one, right? That's the thing. Yeah, that's true. I'm going to give you one. It's a little bit more of a meatball down the middle. We'll finish on a light note because that was some heavy lifting from us. Critters or Ghoulies as a franchise?
Oh. I think I'm going to have to go with Critters.
I'm with you, man. I'm with you. Ghoulies are fun, but I don't know. I feel like the Critters films hold up pretty well.
Yeah. I also like they were on Channel 11 afternoon movies all the time, so I've definitely seen them more. Yeah, because what's like the third one has Leonardo DiCaprio in it, right?
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. There's that, you see that screen like that still of like a promo, not a pro, like a behind the scenes still with him with one of the creatures.
Yeah. No, I think Critters. I think to me also Critters was just more fun creature design.
Agreed. The Ghoulies are just kind of slimy and
yeah,
they're okay. But the Critters is a really fun creature design.
I will say though, the Ghoulies VHS cover scared the shit out of me when I was a kid.
Oh, of course. I think everyone like sort of there's that association with toilets, right?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I like, you know, I was watching movies I shouldn't have been watching when I was a kid, and I definitely remember browsing the horror section and seeing that VHS cover and be like, I don't know if I want to watch this.
I know. It's listen to this before we jump off this. I'm sure you know this, but for those that don't, I didn't, or I'd forgotten about it. No, I don't think I knew this. Bong Joon-ho's next film, Mickey 17. Listen to this cast. Robert Pattinson, Stephen Yeun, Naomi Aki, Tony Collette, Mark Ruffalo.
Holy shit.
That's an unreal cast. Like
that is amazing. Dude, Robert Pattinson, he is so good.
He's the man. I love anything he does. I've been saying it. I'm telling you, the receipts are out there. I watched Twilight with my wife probably 13, 14 years ago. I didn't want to watch it. I'm not
sure.
But to each their own. My wife watches a lot of garbage.
Yeah.
Me. So I remember watching. I remember saying on the show, hey, this Pattinson guy, man, he's got it. He's so good, man.
I do appreciate how he basically used the money he got from Twilight to just make whatever he wants.
The platform, right? Gave him the platform to be able to do.
And Christina Stewart, like Kristen Stewart, yeah, like
good actress.
You know, Clouds of Sils Maria.
Fantastic. Personal shopper, I think.
Fantastic.
Yep. Yeah, she's a good actress. I think she kind of got shit in
Adventureland. She's great.
Yeah, in Adventureland. I know, she's a good actress. She kind of, unfortunately, it feels like people kind of jumped on her. Publicly just for perceived bad behavior. I don't know what it was.
I think women are more criticized.
Sadly.
You know, sadly. But I even liked her in Underwater, which was the last movie I watched in theaters before COVID.
Yeah, we saw that at the drive-in actually.
Yeah.
Underwater, good lord. So that's this or that. I can't believe we were going to hit each other with the same one. You know what that's like? That's like in, Rocky 2 when they both punch each other at the same time and end up on the mat?
Oh, yeah. I think that's 2.
Yeah, that's what that was like.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to take a short break and we're going to come back. And did we really talk about what we're even covering this week?
I don't think so.
Good Lord. So yeah, this is... we're going to, you know what, we're going to save it, man. We're going to save it for after the break. We're going to play a little Fleetwood Mac. And if you know this film, you know this song is in the film. So we're going to be right back and Rufus can talk about what we're covering.
Thank you.
welcome back to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. So I don't know, in sort of true GGTMC fashion, Rufus blended right in with the bungling we like to do. And we forgot to mention, at least I think we forgot to mention, what we're covering this week. So it was Rufus's turn to program, being the guest and all. And Rufus, why don't you let the listeners know what you picked and why you picked it?
Sure. So I picked World on Wire, which is a 1973 German science fiction television film. It's actually two television film, I guess maybe a serial. Is two films a serial? I don't know. Directed by Rainer Werner Fassbinder. Shot on 16mm, and it's sort of a science fiction, philosophic science fiction noir. Film, noir, yeah, about a simulated reality that this company is running to get market information for investments. So they've created this world where there's about 10,000 units, they call them, of digital people that don't realize that they're digital. And then there's some corporate things going on. And our main character, played by Klaus Lowitzch, I do not know how to pronounce anything in German. So he is a very sexy man who
gotta say, man, he's short.
He is very short, but his shirtless scenes make up for it.
he is a real GGTMC icon. He takes off his shirt. He is, as I said to you off the air, yeah, he made Paul Naschy proud in this one.
Yeah, he spends a lot of this film shirtless. he's one of the professors at this, and this Professor Vollmer, who's played by Adrian Hoven, is the technical director, who dies mysteriously. So Fred Stiller, who this is Klaus's character, sort of is the new technical director. So he's sort of looking into why this guy died, and then some people start disappearing in mysterious ways that no one seems to remember who they were. So he starts investigating that, and that's sort of the impetus for the rest of the film. Why did I pick this movie? I have a huge blind spot for German cinema. I'll just be honest, for most European cinema, because my specialty was Asian cinema. And I knew we programmed a huge Fassbinder retrospective at Film Society of Lincoln Center when I was there, and I saw bits and pieces of most of his films, but haven't really watched any of his stuff fully when we were teching the prints. And I remember watching the scene where he's sort of in the helmet going into this virtual reality, and I was like, what is this movie? Like, I need to watch this. So when Will was like, oh, pick a movie, I just looked onto my shelf and saw the Blu-ray sitting there and was like, yeah, we're gonna watch World on a Wire. So it wasn't really any other thought put behind why I picked this other than that.
But I'm glad you picked it. You know, this is one we haven't done enough German cinema, and I'd said to you off the air that I've seen, you know, like the new German cinema, what a great time, you know, what a creative well it was. There's a lot of, you know, your Herzogs, your Wenders, Fassbinder.
Yeah, Wolfgang Petersen, Uli Lamell,
who, you know, became a successful filmmaker.
Who has some serious drip in this movie.
Dude. The Riz. Yeah, no, he comes on strong. He's got like this like one Hunter Green kind of suit, man. It's,
oh my god. So nice. I love his like sort of checkered plaid wide breasted suit jacket that he wears too.
Yeah, and he's such a baby face in this.
Yeah,
it's crazy. But yeah, this I just think I'm glad you picked it. You know, because that's one of the things, right? Like when we look, I can tell you sort of the process. We have our sort of comfort foods or our go-tos. And there's a conscious decision sometimes to pick stuff that, like, to get our fiber and our vegetables in. And those aren't bad things. Those are essential. And this was one, because of the runtime, like, I would have never.
I didn't know the runtime when I picked it.
No, but that, I'm glad you did. Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, I'm grateful you did, because it's one of those where you just keep going, but everything worked out. Usually my weekends, I'm just breathless. And I sit down at like 9:30 or 10 at night after being busy all day to watch the film for the show that I'm going to record in like 6 hours. But the stars aligned. One sec. The stars aligned for this one, because our day went smooth. I made an amazing French onion soup pasta for dinner. We ate it early. The kids were out, like, you know, one son was out with a lady friend. One son was going out to the movies with his friend. Therese was content to let me watch a 3 hour plus German movie. she did her own thing. So, and the clocks went back.
Yeah. So, yeah. We were like, I started watching this on Friday, and then my mom wanted to watch a Hallmark movie. So we sort of, you know, all watched that together. And then I was like, it's 10 o'clock. I don't want to watch a 3 hour movie. and then, yeah, last night it was the same. Like, we had worked all day to winterize our property, you know, like, had to take in all the outdoor furniture and everything, cover the plants. And then we got in just in time. My mom was like, hey, we're going to order pizza. And I said, sure, sounds good. And my mom and Emily watched Justified.
Yep.
And I watched World on a Wire.
Amazing. Amazing. Everything worked out. The German film gods were smiling on us.
Yeah. It was funny, though, because Emily, who is German, was like, you never watch German movies. I was like, I know. I'm trying to expand my horizons.
But isn't that, you know, not to sidebar too much, but isn't that one of the great things about this thing we love so much, film? Like, there are so many rabbit holes to go.
Oh, 100%.
Like, it's not just that. So you could watch this, right? And you could go, wow, you know something? I got to see every other Kurt Robb joint that ever came out, or Klaus Lowitch or Lovitch. You know what I mean? Like, you could go down those rabbit holes, or it's so many rabbit holes that you're never, you know, and I never want to lament that I'm not going to see everything, because, you know, there is sort of a beauty in the journey of seeing and discovering new things, right? So, yeah, that's the good thing, man. So there's lots of good German films. We can talk about some off the air for sure.
Sure.
Let us know either individually or collectively which ones they dig. That's great.
Yeah.
So this is on the Criterion Channel.
Yep, and I watched it on Blu-ray, and we had a little scare last night when you were like, what streaming service are you using to watch it? And I was like, oh, I'm watching a disc. I forgot about that.
My name's Will, and I like to get caught with my pants down regularly. So I was
That's the sexy GTMC way.
That is, man.
Pants down.
The European cuts are always out on display, because I thought this was on Criterion. And then I did like a brief search a few days ago, and I was like, oh, I don't see it. Oh, I'll find it. Of course, famous last words, right? I get busy, this and that. And then finally, before even checking Criterion, I'm like, yeah, man, yo, how did you watch this? And you're like, oh, I got the disc. I'm like, fuck. You know? But I went and checked. Yeah, Criterion Channel's got it. They came correct. They got it split into the two parts. So we were good to go. This one, we should say, is adapted from a book.
Yes. So it's adapted from Simulacron 3 by Daniel Galoue. And it was also made into a movie, The 13th Floor, from 1999, which is not a good movie.
Right.
And it was pretty early on sci-fi. At least with the book came out in 64. This was pretty early, like, science fiction take on simulated realities.
And just how society, the thing I find so fascinating about this is how visionary it is as a film. And it's made for almost, like you had said off the air, it's made for,
I think it was $300,000 or something.
Yeah, it's not, not a very, it's a very talky film.
It's very European science fiction from this era.
Very much. And it trades in, there's a certain level of anxiety and kind of Kafka-esque rabbit holes and paranoia, noir. And the sci-fi is more about, and this is the kind of sci-fi I really dig, where it's not about the spectacle, it's about the idea or the sort of existential thing or philosophical thing that allows us to look at our relationship with technology and what makes us human and all these things that kind of stir up a lot of debate and sort of thought within people, right? And that's the stuff I love, which this really trades in heavily.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's interesting too, because it's so it really outlines, like, this movie is basically The Matrix without any action or special effects.
It is The Matrix right down to, so there's the scene when he talks about the coffee.
Yep.
And he says, "How do you know the coffee's brown?" And it's like the chicken scene or the food meat scene or something
I'll tell it now, but there's that scene where he first goes, the second time he goes into the simulated world. Mm-hmm. And then he has to get on the phone to get out.
Yeah, which is totally The Matrix.
And it blew my mind because this movie was basically unavailable.
Forever.
For 40 years, right? Until 2010 or something.
Right. Officially, yeah.
Yeah, so maybe the Wachowski sisters saw this, or somebody writing with them saw this, you know.
Well, guaranteed. Well, it's no different than Sean Cunningham, who denies ever seeing Bay of Blood.
Oh my God!
It's like, dude, you made Bay of Blood, and you're claiming that it's original. Come on, man.
Yeah.
But it's sort of, and I'm not saying
I don't think I think the Wachowskis are pretty open about
they
ripped off all these anime cyberpunk things. No.
Yeah, I don't think they're I think they're very transparent about that. But it's funny how, you know, watching that and then watching this again, it's like, yeah, this is The Matrix.
It is like 100% The Matrix. Like, it's really fascinating. Overall, some of my early notes were like how kind of close this actually was almost to Alphaville too.
Yeah.
Where there are movies that are heavily science fiction and in the same realm of other like US science fiction at the time, which was pretty dour and nihilistic.
Yep.
Because of all of the social changes, the economic uncertainty. We're seeing that again now, you know, like all of the sort of dystopian world ending science fiction that's popular now, you know. Science fiction very clearly represents the times that it was made.
It does. So, reflect the anxieties of the artists and the
society. You have like Rollerball and all these like big spectacle movies coming out of
Logan's Run, or even what's the one I'm thinking of?
Soylent Green.
Big time. What's the one? Yul Brynner. West.
Westworld also came out in 73, actually, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know.
Total tangent. But one of my all-time favorite cinematic sequences is Yul Brynner walking down the corridor in Westworld, and his eyes are, like, sort of flashing.
They're, like, that, like, kind of, like, glint in them.
Yeah.
I know, man. And it's so cool to see. I'm telling you, I don't know if this has ever been, and I think I've said this before on the air, but he obviously was a major influence on Michael Myers.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, he is like the original slasher.
Yeah. Just unstoppable. Not really running after you. Just like coming straight forward.
Yep. Yeah.
So, yeah. So I don't know. Like, this movie was, I didn't really know what to expect going into this movie, to be honest.
Oh, like, I thought you'd watched. So you'd cracked the Blu-ray like yesterday then.
Yeah. Literally first time watch. The only sequence I'd ever seen from this movie was him in the helmet.
Yep.
And so I kind of knew what it was about. I know enough about Fassbender from cultural osmosis to like kind of know what his style is.
Yep.
And so I was like, ooh, this is going to have some sweet GGTMC style.
Dude, yeah.
And I really just wanted to watch it. So I was like, this is the perfect excuse. And I was blown away that he was only 27 when he directed this.
Well, what's wild about him, about Fassbender, is how prolific he was, right? Like, he just, what a star that just burned so bright, you know, and then left, unfortunately, you know, very brief, after a brief, you know, 37 years old, I think, when he died.
Yeah, died from cocaine overdose.
Which is crazy. You got to do a lot of coke to overdose on it.
Yeah, well, I think he was mixing it with barbiturates and all sorts of stuff. Yeah.
Mixing with everything. Yeah.
I mean, and he's a controversial guy, you know, like, was very out bisexual at a time where that, you know, maybe in Europe was a little bit less frowned upon, but not really. And had just very volatile relationships with his, the people that he was with, and half of them are in this movie.
yeah, interesting. I can't imagine the sets and stuff. What an interesting filmmaker, you know, 44 directorial credits to his name. It's funny, this is kind of funny because I think about him, and the only two films that he's been associated with that we've done on the show, one was Kamikaze 89, which Joe Yannick had programmed for us. And now it's just kind of, both are kind of like similar in that they trade in a lot of kind of sci-fi and other things. So that's interesting. Like a cyberpunk film, right? So yep. This is kind of cyberpunky too, right? So
yeah, and I think, like, it's, I don't know. I mean, I've seen bits and pieces of Fox and His Friends, Corel.
What about Ali Fieritz?
Ali Fieritz the Soul, and then Berlin Alexanderplatz. Like,
I haven't seen it yet.
I haven't had time to watch a 13-hour movie.
Oh. Okay.
But yeah. So I don't know. I think this movie was really interesting to me. That it sort of traded any of the sci-fi spectacle of special effects for these very philosophical questions and extremely clever use of set and costume design.
And sound design.
Oh, yeah. The music in this, like that weird sort of electronic heartbeat that like comes through, especially there's like this later on, I think maybe in the second half, they're having this tense company meeting in this like black room where the, like, you just see the lights reflected into like infinity behind them, because there's mirrors in every single scene in this film.
Yeah.
And like there's just this intense like electronic heartbeat, like, just while they're like sort of deciding what to do with our Dr. Stiller. It's a hard movie to talk about without spoilers.
Yeah, because I think some of the I don't know if joy, but I guess some of the joys as a film, or, you know, this is like a Russian nesting doll too, right?
Yeah,
like it's just inside, and like you're kind of going inside the layers of the film and peeling them back, and it's yeah, and I certainly don't want to give away some of the key plot points, but
sure.
You know, one of the things that I really dig about this film too is watching it, you're very struck with how it feels like a less, because again, my favorite sci-fi films deal with the same ideas that this one deals with. So, and these are not some deep cuts, but like 2001,
sure,
Blade Runner.
Yep.
And I feel like both of those films, or maybe not so much specifically 2001, but I feel like Kubrick, like this has some Kubrick in it. It has some Tarkovsky in it.
Oh, yeah.
Philosophical stuff. But it feels like less operatic Kubrick in some ways, just because of some of the ideas. We'd mentioned, of course, The Matrix. But it's remarkable to see something like this and how influential it is. And you know, the other thing too, like watching this, you can't help the cinematography, like you can't help but feel an overall sense of like surveillance and paranoia, very Eastern European kind of paranoia.
Yeah, that sort of early shot when he's meeting one of the investigators, and it's like shot like an Ozu shot, like it's from the floor.
Yeah.
And it's like going under all of these chair legs, tracking him walking through this restaurant, and like sits and he like watches, and then it tracks back as he's like leaving. I was just like, man, there's just some insane cinematography in this movie.
Yeah.
And the cinematographer was actually Michael Bauhaus, was actually part of the 13th Floor. I think he produced the 13th Floor remake. And I was like, what happened?
That's wild. I'm curious. I'm curious what else he's shot. But I mean, yeah, like you get stuff, like you said, it's remarkable, especially considering the hardware that they were working with back then. But like stuff kind of pierced around objects and around corners. And
yeah. And just like the logistics of shooting with that many reflective surfaces and mirrors.
What a nightmare. Look at this. So Bauhaus has shot some pretty heavy films. Goodfellas, Dracula, yeah. Bram Stoker's Dracula, Gangs of New York, After Hours, Color of Money, Last Temptation of Christ. We work with Marty a lot.
Yeah.
Shot The Departed. Like he's, you know.
And Wild Wild West for Barry Sonnenfeld.
Yeah, there you go, man. So he's, you know, certainly an acclaimed cinema. But yeah, you think about the technical challenges of shooting with a lot of these reflective surfaces, and it's testament to the work that he does. Right. And it's testament to Fassbender, just the people that he gets together. Like we look at Mike, right. Mike is another filmmaker who is extremely prolific. It's remarkable to see that level of excellence from people that are that prolific.
Right. And I think something too is like Mike, Fassbender worked so quickly.
Yeah.
You know, I think they shot this movie in 40 days or something like that.
That's crazy.
Which is insane for a 3.5 hour movie. A little more than 3.5 hours. And from what I was reading, like, I guess he used a lot of first takes, but it's like the staging, it's so carefully constructed.
It is
staged, and it's just like, how did you do that just on the fly, basically?
That's someone with a real gift for what he's doing. Some people love directing, they become directors. He obviously loved it and had like a major gift for the craft, right? Yeah. Like, you know, one other thing I want to just shout out, because I don't want to forget, is So did you ever watch Modern Family?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about for just a minute how Siskins is like the evil corporate Ty Burrell.
Yes.
Oh my God.
100%. Yes.
Dude is the German like daddy of Ty Burrell.
100%. I was thinking about the like while I was watching it.
It's like, you know, in the movies have like an evil twin. He was like Burrell's evil twin in this.
Yeah. He was one of, I loved Siskin. The swankiest house party this side of the Great Beauty.
Dude, big time.
Ingrid Cavan singing The Boys in the Back Room as like the camera slowly sort of goes around this party. So it's like this house party that, Stiller goes to, and there's this giant sort of circular pool with like carpeted things going right up to the pool. And there's like these basically naked men doing gymnastics. They have like I don't know what they're called. They're rings that hang from the ceiling.
Yeah, like the gymnast rings.
Yeah, gymnast rings. I'm sure there's a name for it.
There's probably a more technical name. You all know what I mean.
But there's just these two guys like in there like flexing, doing like gymnastics out of the water as like everybody's sort of like, I think this is also a good scene that was like, took me a while to get into this movie's pacing.
So I think you bring up a good point, because this film has a very cold opening.
Yeah.
Right. And when you get into it, you're like, wait a second, is this the beginning of the film?
Right.
And it just, it pulls you right in immediately. But I, you know, thinking of Fassbender as a director, I'd like to think that, you know, A, he's not going to make concessions to hold an audience's hand. But more importantly, I think that by have us sort of flail and grasp for footing and sort of to understand where we are in the landscape, I think is in the spirit of our central character, right?
Oh, 100%. And I think it's like the underlying sort of theme is that like sort of Zeno's paradox of Achilles and the tortoise. So that they bring up a lot in the movie, but I don't think they ever explain it.
So no matter how much we try to catch up, we can't.
Exactly. And I think
we've caught up and understand what's happening. No, you don't.
Yeah. And I think it's fascinating. Like once I sort of like, and this house party was sort of like the beginning of me getting into being like, okay, I kind of grok what's going on, but I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah. With you, man.
And like, because everything's so stilted and artificial.
Yeah. Even to the point, like some of the way people are like just blocked in a scene and
they're sitting like 3 feet apart. They're not talking to each other. They're just staring at Stiller.
Emotionless, motionless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Stiller's acting too was interesting because it was like very kind of flat and then all of, not flat, but like
stoic.
And then all of a sudden it would flip into like this sort of histrionic, like very melodramatic, which is more of what I associate with Fassbender.
Sure.
Is this melodramatic mode of storytelling and acting. Yeah, I thought that party scene was fantastic.
It was. And you know what's funny, too, thinking about all those characters that are like that in scenes, like looking at a term that I only know because of my kids, frankly. But you know the term NPCs?
Yes. Yep.
Non-playable characters.
Yep.
So it feels like a lot of these people feel like NPCs in those scenes.
Yeah, 100%.
Like they're just because it's a virtual reality world, right?
Yeah. So
it's pretty cool, man. It's pretty cool. It's just it's.
And I like certain things that sort of like predate video games too. Like when he first gets inserted into the simulation, It's a first person view.
It totally is, and it's got like that like.
You're driving. He's driving the truck or whatever.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, it's like flashing because something goes wrong. His first insertion and like it's flashing like, you know, the text coming up on press X to leave or whatever.
And that's the thing I think we have to really be in awe of is, you know, as much as we talk about sometimes films are creating film language, this is doing things pre-video game language.
Yeah.
And things that we've taken as just, well, of course it's like that. Well, hang on. There weren't video games yet, really. Like this is...
Yeah.
Yeah,
and it's interesting too because it's a lot of like video.
Yeah.
So like it's shot on 16mm film, but the way that they monitor the world is like through like CCTV feeds basically.
Oh, which again is sort of commentary on that sort of surveillance state.
Right? Yep, 100%.
Paranoia, right? Like you're always being watched and you tie that in with like sort of government control and ethics and manipulation that you get from the corporations and how they're tied in with the government. And it just.
Right. Yeah, and like that's that whole subplot with Uli Lamel being like trying to figure out why this corporation is in deep with the government and like what kind of things are they hiding, which is very prescient right now.
Huge.
With how tech companies and algorithms are basically controlling how people vote and think, and you know, it's scary. And this movie is like basically kind of predicting that. And I think it's interesting because this is also the same time frame like Marshall McLuhan and like all these got like video was becoming a thing in the art world.
Yeah,
and they were coming up with all of their own. Understand. Sorry, Siri. they're trying to come up with their own language and stuff, and I feel like some of that is sort of keyed in this movie too with the use of video, the use of their those cool retro future camera phones they have in the offices.
Oh, big where, time.
Yeah. You know, where it's like videos everywhere. It's sort of this omniscient, ever-present, like, thing.
You know what it reminds me of, too? Like, of course, it's all those things because of its, you know, like I said, Europe at the time, Eastern European sort of anxieties with surveillance. But even like Coppola's The Conversation.
Oh, yeah.
Where you just get more and more paranoid about. And it also kind of plays into like noir-y tropes of you can't trust anyone.
Yeah. And that was interesting because this is basically like definitely their, especially Stiller's style. In the movie, suits yeah. and stuff is very 40s noir.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know what's funny as we're talking about this film? I'm thinking about, like, I wouldn't recommend anyone put this on at, like, 11 o'clock at night after a long day. Oh,
definitely not. Put it on at, like, 6 and six. Be prepared to, like, be kind of confused for, like, a good 30 to 45 minutes before you're, like, get into the rhythm of the storytelling and the acting and
world.
The world. Yeah.
Or better yet, worlds.
Yes.
Right. So it, yeah. And let's shout out Stiller's very GGTMC whip.
Oh man.
Batman. Yes.
Oh yeah.
That in Germany at the time, I don't know how hard that was to get a hold of, but that's
and I think they shot it in Paris.
Oh, did they? Interesting. Like, I didn't France. Know that.
Yeah.
Which probably explains, I think Eddie Constantine's in the back end in that like, yep. taxi scene. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Which he's that's the one scene that's clearly dubbed.
Yes. Oh yeah. Yeah. there's a couple scenes where the sound gets very weird and it's like, oh yeah, you're dubbing. This is dubbed. And then Peter Chattel's in this and he has like the coolest velvet suit.
Oh yeah.
Of all time. Like I love a good velvet suit. He yeah. rocks this hard.
He does.
And also very GGGMC, one of the sexiest nightclubs ever.
I'll tell you what, man. I think all of Fassbender's proclivities are on display in that scene.
100%.
Yeah, that's a very GGTMC club though, man. There's lots of like muscled up oily dudes.
Yep.
Girls dance and everyone's yeah, topless.
Topless girls. And then like that sort of Marlene Dietrich stand-in just like goes and like touches everybody's chest
yeah.
as she's walking through the crowd.
Cute.
Yeah, I love that scene. And I also really liked sort of the playfulness in some scenes.
Yeah, I agree.
There's that press conference where Uli Lamel's sort of grilling Siskin, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, why, where's this contract? Why aren't you releasing your data? Da, 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 da. And then Siskin's like, and now a snack. And the press team just like runs over to the free food.
And you know, something that's the thing. There's so many layers to this film, but that's one of the things I really love too. And you touch on it right there is kind of the adversarial combative feel of some of the conversations.
Yes.
Because yeah. Stiller is trying to get to the bottom of everything. And he has people that he works for, but clearly, you know, he's being manipulated by them and he's trying to prove certain things. So you get this kind of jousting with the characters throughout the film, whether it's Lamel, whether it's Lovitz's character, Stiller, a number of characters, right? So,
yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because it's like that it is adversarial, but at the same time, it's like he almost has to play these like logic games to get to yes. some of the information. You know, there's that scene where he's talking to oh my god, what's his name, Wolfgang, where he's like talking about the guy who disappeared, Gunther Lauss, who's the guy that disappeared at that super crazy house party at the beginning of the movie. And no one remembers him. And the only way he can get to that information is like circuitously describing him to Wolfgang to put into the computer, and then it prints out like here's the 7 possibilities of who this could be in the simulation. Yeah. And yeah. Gunther Lauss is on it and everybody's like, wait, what?
Yeah. It's wild. This is a dense, like a really wild film. You know what scene I love is the scene with Einstein.
Yes.
That scene, that actor, Gottfried John, he's got a really, really unique look. I think the camera really likes him. He's fascinating to look at. And that scene, there's a real sense of urgency. I really dig that scene. I wish he had been in the film more.
I think it's also, he was interesting because of his unique look, it worked as you are clearly a simulated person.
Yeah, I agree with you. And to the point where they use makeup and things to really amplify that, right?
Yeah, he had this sort of like ethereal look. Like he almost looked like poreless.
I know.
Like, again, they're sort of like how CGI humans look. It slips into that uncanny valley of like, wait, you don't look quite right. And they even have the guy on the phone is in this like very harsh, like white makeup with this like bright lipstick on.
Yeah.
Where he has to kick the guy out to like get on the phone so he can get out of the matrix or
Exactly, man. That was very cool.
Some of the other stuff I liked a lot, the sort of shirtless existential discussion on the balcony.
Oh yeah, when he's in those like tan shorts.
Yeah. And the guy he's talking to was one of Fassbender's lovers.
That's what's his name? That's Ali from
El Yeah.
So
yep.
Yeah.
Who actually stabbed somebody, I believe.
Did.
Yeah. So Chris, you wild. Know, what the this is a wild time in Germany, apparently. I love that scene though.
It is a really good scene.
Like it's getting, and that's exactly what you're talking about, where it's like very much like this existential dread.
Yeah.
Of like, who are we? What are we doing? Are we real?
That's the thing, man. This film works on so many levels. It can be taken as sort of like a cyberpunky, noir-y sci-fi film. You can look at it just more philosophical and existential with the circuitry and everything is sort of a metaphor for things. Like it's.
Yeah.
I was going to say, it never feels kind of show-offy. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's not like I feel like Primer, right?
Yeah.
Primer is a very like, look how smart I am.
Yes.
Movie.
Yes, it does. It gives you a lot of verbal diarrhea. And I like the film. I do.
Oh, but, sure. Absolutely.
But it feels almost like. Like intellectual dick swinging for its own yes. sake times.
Whereas this movie, I think, avoids it.
It absolutely does. And there's a lot of big ideas here, both in terms of technology and science and philosophy. And it never feels self-righteous or pretentious, right? It feels right. very accessible still. Now, I'm not saying I could show this to, you know, anyone, but it never, we watch enough films to know when something feels really sort of pretentious. And this is not it.
Yeah, and I think it reminds me in some ways of like it because of the length and the amount of time we get to spend with these characters and tell the story, it allows these ideas to breathe and be introduced slowly, and then they come back in future conversations and sort of get underscored. And I think it's a very It avoids sort of the matrixy, here's the exposition dump.
Well, things beget, it allows it to become much more sort of insidious, right?
Yeah.
As the film goes on.
So. Yeah. And I love like some of these like cool callbacks. So like, you know, when he first goes into the simulation, he's driving the car and there's this first person shot. And then later in the second episode, he's driving again to like sort of get out of the city, and it's another first person shot. Mm-hmm. So there's like these sort of thematic callbacks. The underwater car sequence. Oh, I don't want to give anything away, but there's that one shot of the underwater car, and I was like, that's such a good shot.
Yeah, no, there's some good.
Yeah. The swolest chef in all of cinema.
Oh man.
The dude was so brolic. Like dude, like just jacked, shirtless.
Nope. Yeah.
You know, chopping a head off of a fish or whatever. And I was just like, whoa. Clearly, Fassbender really likes shirtless black men.
He's into the beef, man. He liked the beef.
Yeah. And then some of the other stuff is like, I loved the cabin sequence.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like the tracking shot that sort of swirls around and there's like these very like weird fake trees that sort of add to the artifice. And like this shot goes from the front of the cabin. And there's a lot of things in this movie where they're like tracking through. Like there's an early shot in the first part of the film where he's having a conversation and he sort of like loops through his office and he starts opening these doors. So he starts in the middle of the frame on sort of the right and then comes and sits down at the bottom right frame and then like loops through these doors and then ends up in the top middle of the frame, all while having the same conversation. So there's a lot of these interesting like movements. And there's this great scene where there's a tracking shot around the whole cabin as he's opening the windows.
Yeah.
And it sort of follows him. And I was like, man, like, there's just like a lot of attention to detail and staging in this movie. And then, of course, the most dramatic porch jumping and explosion ever.
Oh, yeah. Did we get a proper cabin explosion in this?
Yeah, it's like the one big, like sort of the all of the action and like they blow it all in the last like 20 minutes, which is nice. It's like this cathartic. Like it's such a long, slow burn up until that point. And then Squibbs and the slow fall was another favorite part of mine.
Our apologies to the listeners.
Yeah. I don't know what happened.
I heard cathartic.
Yes. So I was saying that it was cathartic, like the all of this like sort of action toward the end. Like you have this long, slow burn and then it just gets crazy. And like his luck starts falling and like everything's working, like the world is working against him. Like there's that weird tree fall. There's the cabin explosion. And then, of course, there's Squibbs and the slow fall.
that's almost like Turkish Death Wish.
Yeah, I was like, this is the best way that this movie could have ended.
So yeah, full disclosure, everyone, we had a few technical glitches. Hopefully, it's kind of ironic considering
what we're talking about.
Glitching, man. I'm just hoping Godfrey John doesn't walk through the room and I got to hit a phone quick. there's action beats at the back end of the film with like that slow kind of Turkish death wish death dance that happens. And that's cool. You know, actually, I don't want to say what film it's kind of like because it'll kind of spoil it. But you know what's weird too is some of the performances, and I think you'd said this, but some of the women in the film too, like there's this very sort of robotic, creepy moments.
Oh my God, yes. Yeah, 100%.
And there's moments when it toggles between those, right? And it's really, really unique and, you know. You know, another film this totally feels like is Chinatown.
Ooh.
What's that?
Yes. I haven't thought about that. That's a good connection.
Feels to me. And I wrote that down right at the back end of the film. I wrote, trust no one. It's Chinatown.
Yeah.
Yeah. Forget it. What's his name? Forget it. Stiller.
Jake or whatever. Forget it. Stiller. It's time to Chinatown. Chinatown. Forget it, Stiller. It's Simulacrum.
yeah, exactly. Well played, man. Well played. That's awesome.
Yeah, that was sort of my notes. I mean, without getting any spoilery stuff, but like I really dug this movie. Like it, and again, it took me 30, 45 minutes to get in. I was like, oof. At the beginning, I was like, I don't know if I have the sort of attention span for this. And then I got into its pacing and it just clicked.
Once you get to the rhythm, right? You get into the rhythm of it. I agree with you 100%. Couple quick notes because I covered a lot of stuff. So Fleetwood Mac's Albatross is used perfectly in this film. I love it. Oh, it's so good, man. And I mean, that wasn't on my bingo card, like to have a Fleetwood Mac song in this film. But if you know Albatross, like it so runs counter to so much of their catalog.
Yeah.
Right. So did you catch Stiller's Corvette license plate?
No.
Fast 277. Very amazing. I think Schmidt does a good job. Like he's, you know, and I won't take credit for this. Ryan Johnson said this on one of the kind of excerpts on the channel. He's talking about this film, but at times his character feels very bogey. Like he feels very kind of noir-y bogey.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
You know, which I can kind of see, you know, what's funny too about his performance, and you'd alluded to this, is that sometimes he's bogey and some moments he's Howard Dean. Like it's so random, some of the weird like shrieks or sort of animated gestures he does. It's just, I don't know.
Man, that's a callback.
He does that, yeah, like he does.
Remember when that could ruin somebody's political career? Ah, those were the days.
And look where we are now. Yeah, those were the good old days. Poor Howard Dean, man. Getting ruined on an awkward scream. Now here we are. So good Lord. But Schmidt does a good job with a lot of internal acting. Like he's a good lead in the film. I think he's a good physical presence. I think he does a lot of kind of stoic stuff. He loves a good elbow patched jacket.
Yes.
So, you know, very cool there. Shout out to Cronenberg possibly cribbing from this movie for Scanners with like the kind of shrill digital sounds with like the head kind of pain.
Oh yeah. I was wondering like something about that was like, oh, this is reminding me.
Yeah.
It's definitely, yeah. Cronenberg. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I don't have a whole lot of notes, man. I covered a lot of ground when you were talking. I want to encourage people to not be put off by this because you can watch it in two parts.
Yes.
Right? Like I wouldn't watch them too far apart, like one month and one the next. But
if I had to go back, I would have watched part one on Friday night and part two last night.
So you could totally do that. Like do them back to back nights. If you got the 3 hour block, do it, or 3.5 hour block, do it. But if you need to split it, because that's how it was made. The two parts are a little different. The first part is more mystery, kind of philosophical stuff. The second part, it has a bit more of an emotional core to it. But yeah, no, it's...
yeah, I saw somebody on Letterboxd had reviewed it, and it was like something like part one is we live in a computer world. Part two, my love for you transcends our separate realities. Like so accurate. Yes.
Yeah, it is though. It totally is. They're very different. Not very different. Like they tie together well. It doesn't not feel organic. But yeah, they're very little different in terms of their approach. Let me kick it over to you for make or break, MVT, and score.
I think make or break was the sexy house party.
Oh, yes.
Because it's an early indication of are you going to get through the rest of this film or not?
Yep.
Man, MVT is either the shirtless balcony sequence or Uli LaMelle's jacket game.
Well, yeah, there's something to be said for his jacket game.
I think score for me is, I mean, you guys do it out of 10, right? I'm gonna say like maybe 8.5, maybe 8.75 out of 10.
All right.
And the reason I say that is just because of how long it took for me personally to get into the flow of the movie.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's fair. So I am going to go with the make or break scene as the Einstein scene.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of good scenes in this film, a lot of good discussion. But that scene to me, like I said, that really feels like an exciting moment in the film when we're going to finally, and our lead character is going to finally get some answers and some clarity about things. And there's a certain sense of urgency. He's got 5 minutes, you know, to figure it out. I really like that scene. I think it's a really good scene. MVT Fassbender. With a lot of things, but I just feel like he's the guy that brings this all together. And it's to make a 3.5 hour movie that deals with this many big ideas, both spiritually and technologically, as this
for $300,000 in 40 days.
The recipe is there for an unwatchable, soupy mess. Just, yeah. And it's incredible. He said, very prescient. Incredible. And my score is the same as yours. It's an 8.75 out of 10, man.
Yeah.
This is an incredible film. Just, you got to give yourself over to it. Like you said, it's, you kind of got into the rhythm and whatnot, but it's very unique in his filmography, but at the same time, you know, certain themes, you know, you see, you can't help but revisit either through visual motifs, fixations, or themes. So
yeah, well, and it's also so clearly like this movie lays the groundwork for so much of the great science fiction.
Oh man, does it ever.
Like I was thinking about like this even down to like some of my like sort of more obscure things, like Serial Experiments Lane, which is a Japanese anime from the early 2000s, I think.
Yep.
Deals with some of the same exact questions of virtual life, online, like you know, who's real, what's not real. And it's like I think all of these things owe so much to this movie, even if it was inaccessible. Like I think they put it out into the ether.
yeah for sure. It was written about, and I'm sure there was tape trading and stuff.
Sure, like that. Of course, yeah,
file sharing. So yeah, this is one that if you like, I think it's so influential, and like you said, really lays the groundwork for a lot of the important films in the genre. Yeah, so that's the big show, man. That's the big show. Rufus,
thanks for having me on. I really kind of dusted off my podcasting.
Awesome,
after man. A while.
This was awesome. It was awesome to have you on. Awesome to get back in the chair with you. I know Rick's going to want to get back on with you real quick. Yeah. Think about what you want to cover next, whether it's one of the ones we said, All American.
I think Foul King, maybe. I don't know. We're All American Murder. One of those two, for
and,
sure.
Or if it's Column C, you decide. Yeah. Let's back on quick and get moving on something, man.
Great.
That was wonderful. So thank you again. And of course, that leaves us with one thing left to say. Adios.
Sayonara.
Thanks for listening. You can find the gentleman at ggtmc.com, and you can email the gentleman at midnightcinema@gmail.com.